Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, April 14th, 2009. Waiting for the rest of my committee, but while we're doing that, I'd like to remind everyone that cell phones, Blackberries, all those things do interfere with our sound equipment. So if you hear buzzing up here, it's probably Senator George. And so if you could please turn off your phones, it would be helpful. I'm going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 20 and ask Senator Montes Anderson to come forward. Thank you. Welcome. Sorry we don't have a larger group here for you today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator George, and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham Troutdale-Wood Village in Fairview. And I'm sorry I wasn't here to testify on Senate Bill 20 when it first came before you early on. It was just an oversight on my part. But in working with the home builders and the Department of Consumer Business Services, as well as the Lung Association, we really feel that this issue is a much broader issue than we even thought. That we really want to look at best practice research. We really want to know exactly where radon is an issue in the state of Oregon. We need to look at the mapping. We need to understand older homes versus new homes. And there's just a whole lot of information that we want to gather and work on to see how the if we even need a bill like this and how it can be incorporated into the codes, if that's even necessary. So with that, I would like you to just let the bill die, and we will be working on it during the interim.
Thank you, Senator, for your clarification on your intent for this important issue. We had some very interesting testimony, but I think speaking on behalf of the committee, we recognize that it's pretty complex and we need to find our way. So Okay. Thank you for making those points on the record. And Scott Berry is here. Scott, did you want to say anything? He's shaking his head no, but walking forward, so inconsistent.
For the record, Chair Bonamici and member of the committee, Scott Berry of the Oregon Home Builders, and I would just echo the words of the senator that we're going to spend some time during the interim work on this issue, and I think we could probably get to a solution potentially even without a bill for next session.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'd like to mention that due to the good work of this bill, I actually went and got a radon test. I'm waiting my results, so thank you very much.
Thank you, and I know there were radon test kits that were provided to us during the hearing. So.
I went and bought my own.
Did you? Yeah. Now you don't have to report it.
I don't have to report it.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 20, and I believe that will be the last we'll see of that bill for this session. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 731 and ask Lori to please give us a summary of where we are. This has been up a couple of times, and if you want to outline for us where we are on this, Lori, and then we have a couple people signed up.
Sure, absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 731, if you remember, was up in March for your hearing and to hear from the folks who have been working on this bill. And since that time, there have been meetings with those persons as part of a work group. And if you remember, Senate Bill 731 has to do with garnishment, and there is an amendment before you that was just received today, Stash 4. The provisions that are most relevant for some of the changes that are made to the garnishment bill as introduced, the Dash 4 amendments protect the amount of exempt funds. If you remember, this has to do with the exempt funds in a garnishment being protected in financial accounts. Protects the amount in the account equal to the amount of certain direct deposit exempt funds in the calendar month preceding the receipt of garnishment. And Senator Girard raised this issue, if you remember, before, and hopefully I summarized that adequately. Well, when he arrives, he can speak to that, perhaps. It also specifies that the protection applies when the financial institution can readily identify the qualifying exempt funds or when the account holder formally identifies the qualifying exempt funds. It increases the garnishment fee paid to financial institution from $10 to $15. It also removes the wildcard provision increase. As the bill, as introduced, increased what is called the wildcard exemption from $400 to $1,000. That increase has been removed in the Dash 4s and returns it to current law.
Thank you, Lori. And we have Sybil Hebb. Do you want to come up, Sybil? And were you bringing anyone with you?
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of Senate Bill 31 with 731 with the Dash 4 amendments. Jim Kaur, my cohort in working on this bill, is here in the audience and is available to answer any questions should the committee have any or should I not be able to answer them. I thought that I would, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time and all of the attention that the committee members have put into this discussion as we've moved over the months. As you know, from the Law Center's perspective, we're concerned about making sure that vulnerable Oregonians who receive exempt funds are not reduced suddenly without warning to $0 and forced to go through a very laborious claim of exemption process in order to get their funds back from collection after collection. So we're grateful for the work that's been put into this proposal by all of the interested parties. The Dash 4 amendments are the result of significant compromises and discussions amongst all of the interested parties. We got them this morning. Many people have been able to read them this afternoon, but I think a few members have not had a chance to fully go over them yet. So I will do a summary and then answer any questions, and then we hope to come back before the committee to move forward with the bill after everyone's had a chance to look through them. So first of all, there's a basic shift in the model of the proposal. Initially, we had proposed that there be one uniform level of protection available to everybody who received certain direct deposit exempt funds. And that was, we chose not to move forward with that model, and as a result of significant feedback from collectors as well as banks, the new proposal is that whatever the sum of the amount of direct deposit exempt funds is, for example, if I receive Social Security deposits of $200 a month, I would be protected at a $200 level in my bank account from any garnishments. If I were to receive $500, then I would receive $500 worth of protection in my account. And so the amount of protection that we propose under the Dash 4 amendments would be dependent on the amount of the exempt deposits that come into the account. So it will vary from person to person. Everything over the protected amount that's in the fund will be subject to garnishment. Anything below that amount will be protected. The types of benefits qualifying for protection under the Dash 4 amendments are the same as in the original bill. So seven types of exempt funds, which are already determined by either state or federal law to be exempt from collection. Those are retirement plan payments, Social Security payments, public assistance payments, unemployment compensation, black lung benefits, veterans benefits, or workers' compensation. So there's no change in the exempt nature of the funds that trigger the protection here. We did make one small change in the Dash 4 is to specify what we mean by retirement plan benefits. That was a request from some of the interested parties that we be more specific about that. So we put a statutory site in and defined them as defined in ORS 18.358, which was, again, a request from the collectors. The protection applies in two circumstances under the proposal. One is if the funds are readily identifiable to the institution. And that is an increase in the flexibility that we gave to the banks in the initial proposal. Originally, we had proposed that the protection be available whenever the funds were reasonably identifiable. Now they must be readily identifiable. So it must be easy to see that the funds are there. I have some examples that I will share of registers that come from bank accounts where you can see $354 Social Security or Supplemental Social Security or VA benefit. So those are the kinds of circumstances that we're talking about. When it's readily identifiable that the funds are exempt, of that exempt nature, then the protection should apply. The other circumstance in which protection could apply is if the account holder has an affidavit on file at the bank that says, this is the type of direct deposit exempt fund that I get. And the bank under the proposal is allowed to require that at the opening of an account, the account holder provide that form if they are currently receiving benefits. They also can make the form available or should make the form available to anyone who wants to use that form to better identify, more easily identify funds that are exempt.
Or more readily identified.
Sorry. More readily identified. So the bill provides that without regard to whether or not there is an affidavit on file, if the funds are readily identifiable, then they would be protected. The fourth major change that we've provided in the bill is that there is a release of liability for any financial institution applying the new provisions of this law. Any determination as to whether or not the funds are subject to garnishment, they're released from liability for that determination so long as they make it in good faith as already defined by law. The term good faith is defined, and that statutory site is included in the -4 amendments. Again, that language was an attempt to respond to the concerns of the banks about what if we get this wrong, and so that's a way to try to resolve that concern. Bank fees are increased under the amendments. The financial institution can charge garnishment fees of $10 under current law. That would be increased to $15. So it would be increased by $5. The bill provides, and the amendments retain, the provision that if there are no funds in the account that are subject to collection, no fee should be charged. We don't want the serving of a garnishment to result in an overdraft on the account of a debtor that has nothing but exempt funds. The other provisions that are retained in the -4 amendments and did exist in the current bill apply to what is the standard that we should be using at claim of exemption procedures at hearings in court if the protection that we propose in the bill doesn't protect funds and an account holder wishes to raise a claim that there were some funds that should in fact have been protected. They have the right under current law to go to court and ask a judge to make that determination. The bill codifies what is, I think, commonly accepted best practice, that the analysis that a court should make at that hearing should be based on the first-in, first-out method of accounting. So as exempt funds come in and then there are expenditures made, the first funds that come in, if they are exempt, those are also considered to be the first funds that are expended. That is the commonly used method of analysis, and we think the best one. So we simply codify that in the bill proposal. So I think that is a summary of the amendments in the -4s. We have had one concern expressed, and I want to make the committee aware that when we're looking at when the bill provides that funds in an account will raise direct deposit exempt funds coming into an account will result in this protection, we needed to create a window within which the account, the financial institution would look to see if there were these funds coming in, and we kind of generally agreed we wanted that to be within the last month. So it's and most of these benefits are received on a monthly basis. Social Security comes the first of every month. Veterans benefits come monthly basis. We were talking with the members of the work group as well as with legislative counsel about what was the best way to describe that window within which the bank was looking at whether the funds were coming in. And we talked about whether it should be 1 month less 1 day or 29 days. And we came up in conversations with the legislative council that it should be the calendar month that preceded the month in which the garnishment was accepted or was received by the bank. And I think a question has been raised about whether or not that might provide more protection than we intended. And so we'll need to look at that language and make sure that we've gotten it right. And I think that there may be an issue there. So we'll continue to talk, but really hope that we can move this proposal through as it will provide substantial protection for what we think are really a vulnerable category of people, especially during these times. So thank you again, all of you, for your time and attention in this discussion.
Sybil, thank you so much for all your work on this, and thanks to Senator Girard as well for the time that he's put into these negotiations. Are there questions, committee? Any questions, Senator Girard?
Madam Chair, the reason that we want to use a term like calendar month instead of a set number of days is that there's not a set number of days in a month. So
right.
if you do it incorrectly and say that you could end up with two firsts where the deposit's going in the first, so there'd be double the exemption, or in case of February, you might have it so that there would be no exemption at all. So
and a leap year would throw you off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, if we just made it, and I don't know the phrase calendar month, but if you're on the 15th day of February, say, then it goes back to the 15th day of January. So, and that's where the calendar month phrase came from. I think it's okay, but some people might have some problems with it.
And Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, thank you very much. And we, I think, do like the calendar month term. The way that it's phrased right now, it says that you need to look at the calendar month that preceded the month in which the garnishment was received. So, for example, if the garnishment was received in April, you would look back to March. Yeah. And the concern, and we were thinking of benefits that are on a monthly basis, but you might get a one-time benefit that then would have extra protection. So we need to
look at that. Might say the same date the month prior. Maybe that would be a better way to...
That's a good suggestion, Senator Dodd.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator. Any other questions for Sybil? Thank you, Sybil,
thank
for
you
our
very much.
Work on this. Pam Levitt, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. I just want to commend everybody who's been working on this. It really has been almost a Herculean effort to really work out the many, many details. Thank you, Senator Girard, for all the work. I just reviewed the amendments, the Dash 4 amendments, very briefly, and I just want to put on the record one of the main issues that credit unions have been concerned about, and I've expressed it in our work group meetings and I believe in previous testimony, is being able to identify these exemptions. Funds. And in Section 2, 3A, it says the provisions apply to payments that a financial institution can readily identify as being one of the types of payments described in subsection 2 of this section. We have talked a little bit about some of the obvious exempt funds that come in, but again, my members tell me that there are many, many exempt funds that come in that are not identifiable. We did work through a number of issues in some proposed conceptual amendments with the proponents of the bill, and they have agreed to a lot of them. But one area that we felt was important was that the payment needed to be identified to the financial institution by the sender of the exempt fund. So it wasn't our responsibility to necessarily say, well, I think that's an exempt fund or that's not an exempt fund. It really is a minor issue of disagreement that we may be able to get some agreement. She didn't necessarily agree with the language that our attorneys had proposed. But I just wanted to put on the record as this bill moves through the process that that is an issue that we are interested in. Obviously, there's the liability protections and the good faith, and I'm sure we will be doing that. But I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that issue.
Thank you. And Pam, does the phrase readily available help in that regard? Because it seems that it's...
Well, readily identify...
Readily identifiable.
The financial institution can readily identify. And I guess that just gave concern to some of our members on, you know, will they be able to readily identify all the types of funds? And so that is really where the language that we were a little stuck on. But, again, we are supportive of the bill in most of the rest of the format. I'm still reviewing the rest of the Dash 4s, so I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you. Questions for Pam?
Madam Chair. Thank you. And, Pam, I don't know, I just wanted to ask your opinion about this language that has people signing an affidavit mm-hmm. when they open the account, mm-hmm. because that seemed like it was testimony that we had in one of the earlier hearings was from a lawyer who mm-hmm. had helped people mm-hmm. do something like that. So does that seem like it's workable?
Yes. Well, I think in our work group meeting, Senator Bonamici and Senator Rosenbaum, in some of our discussions, we kind of got to this concept of a form. And really, financial institutions are not interested in throwing more forms in your face when you open accounts. But it does, we were trying to figure out, I mean, again, we are changing the garnishment law quite a bit here. You know, it's going from the onerous to the judicial process to the financial institution. And so we wanted some protections in place, and that's kind of where we got to that form and the affidavit. So I understand that's one of the provisions. We're still just kind of struggling with that 3A.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Girard.
The term readily identifiable is probably not defined. If we change that to obvious, would that be beneficial? Mm-hmm. Or
Senator Bonamici, Senator Girard, I can just hear my attorney right now. readily obvious. I know that there would be some gray area in that term. You know, the term that we had suggested was identified to the financial institution by the sender of the exempt funds. So the onerous was on whoever was sending us, because the example given was in retirement accounts. It's not always readily identifiable to us that it is an exempt fund. So that we wanted to make sure it was on someone else's lap to make sure that the funds were identified to us as exempt.
I just wonder, I'm not sure, would this be consistent? For example, if all veterans funds are exempt, would it vary by state in some areas, or would federal, what's federally exempt be federally exempt everywhere, I assume, but then would there be differences?
Senator Bonamici, I don't know the answer to that question.
Would have to
that's
ascertain.
A good question.
So, yeah. I'm not sure about that. Maybe Sybil or Jim would know the answer to that. So, well, thank you, Pam, and also thank you for all your work on this. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify? General Caldwell, would you like to testify?
He can answer that question. He was
nodding his head.
He was nodding his head.
We saw you nodding your head.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. I would answer the other question, say the federal law exempts those federal veteran funds from the outset anyway, so I think it's immaterial what the state really would say about it, because it's simply, you know, they're already exempt. So I do not know, and I can't give you an answer whether or not, when those funds are received, whether or not they're identified as exempt. I just can't answer that question. I would make the assumption that they're not, but I don't know that for a fact. I think the other assumption that I think probably would be wise of the industry to probably accept is that anything with a veterans funding stream would be initially considered exempt until they found out otherwise, because there really aren't, I mean, the Veterans Department doesn't send money out as, you know, walking around money. They send money out because you have a claim and you have, you know, a right to that claim, and therefore they send the money out. So I would make the assumption that anything that has veterans on it is categorically exempt, period, if I was in their shoes. Now, whether or not we need to say that in state law or not, I don't know. I'll leave that up to you.
Thank you so much. Questions for the general? Thank you very much.
Thank you
for your continued interest in this.
Well, we appreciate the effort.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here to testify about Senate Bill 731? Well, as Sybil mentioned, we did just receive the Dash 4 amendment, so I would like to give the committee some time to take a look at this. And did we put it back up for Thursday or next Tuesday?
No, I think next Tuesday is the next, isn't it?
Next Tuesday. Right. And some of the things I know that will be discussed among the work group are the issues that were raised today, and I want to make sure that the affidavit isn't something that you know requires a notary or something that would put an additional burden. It could just be a statement under penalty of perjury or something that we don't need to put an additional step in there. And we'll continue working on this. I would like to see this policy go forward. We are also waiting for the fiscal, so that is something that's also going to affect what we do with this bill and where it ends up, because I know that the Department of Revenue does a significant amount of collection. So we'll watch for that fiscal, and in the meantime, if you have concerns, please let me know, and I can pass that along to Sybil so that hopefully when it comes back next time we'll be able to move forward. Anything else? Anyone else would like to say anything about 731? I'm going to close the public hearing on 731 and open a work session on Senate Bill 772. Lori, would you please summarize where we are with the 772.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 772 has been before you several times. March 26th and on the 7th of April, you adopted the Dash 2 amendments, and now it's again before you after a fiscal statement, a fiscal impact statement was corrected by a legislative fiscal office. And so that corrected statement is behind your updated SMS that should be before you as well. And just as a brief summary, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 772 has to do with provisions, legislation brought forward by the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition that had worked during the interim on legislation to improve different laws having to do with landlord-tenant issues in manufactured parks, dwelling parks. There are a variety of provisions that you see and that you've talked about before having to do with utility and service billing methods and some annual registration requirements and an addition of a $25 annual registration fee. There's some civil penalty provisions that were increased from $500 to $1,000. There are some provisions in the bill as introduced that had to do with the placement of political signs and temporary occupancy agreements. The amendments that you adopted on the 7th clarified a variety of terms in the measure. It made some changed some of the provisions so that they were consistent with current law, and also a specific increase in the time for payment of the civil penalty assessed from 30 days to 90 days.
Thank you, Lori. Mm-hmm. So we did request some clarification on the fiscal analysis, and I had several questions about it. We asked some questions. John Van Landingham went along with some of the proponents of the bill and had some conversations about it. It's a situation where there are already, according to this right, corrected version here, there are already 1,269 manufactured dwelling parks in Oregon, and all but 273 have already registered. The Housing and Community Services Department estimates that they could improve registration among those 273 parks that aren't already registered if only they had an additional half-time person to help with compliance and enforcement. So they've included that in the fiscal analysis, and also estimated that they'll need another half-time accounting person because they are this does include this $25 fee that came from the consensus work group. So even though there is the fee that they anticipate, the registration fee would raise approximately $60,000 for the 2009-11 biennium. That's where we ended up with this fiscal analysis. So I have... I'd like to move the bill, adopt the amendment, and move the bill out, and then it's really going to be up to the Senate President's office whether they want to direct this through the Ways and Means process in light of those considerations. So, colleagues, any discussion about that? Maybe we'll go ahead and move the amendment in and then have the discussion.
Madam Chair,
we've already adopted the amendment. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. We've already adopted that.
Right,
too,
yeah.
And that's what, so
you're right.
You're all set to go.
So you're looking to move the bill.
I'm looking to move the bill,
okay.
But I want to have get the committee's input on this on the record about the fiscal.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
The question I would have is, how much is the half FTE worth, because all that is out there one time would be $67,000, and that's if you got everybody to pay the whopping $25. So why, I'm trying to understand why we want to go to add another half person to try to collect this money if we're not looking at copious amounts of money here. And that just seems to tip everything over the edge as far as your financial, the FTEs, having to go with fiscal.
John has, we'll be able to respond to that.
John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid. Madam Chair, Senator Girard, it's the $25 registration fee is an annual registration fee, so they're going to pay it every year. Landlord's going to pay it every year, so it is $60,000 every year. The obligation to enforce the education, mandatory education and registration requirements, been in effect for 4 years, and HCS wants to do these hires so that they could do a better job of making that happen. The thinking in the coalition and with HCS is that if they go after, not a legal term, but go after a couple of people who seem to be flaunting the obligation, that would make an example and would bring the bad actors into line. That would make the landlords who are doing what they're supposed to do happy, because it makes them feel bad that they're doing right and others are getting away with it. So you asked whether it makes sense to hire these people. I didn't make the decision about how many people or who to hire, but that's what they think they need to do a better job of the enforcement and tracking people.
Madam Chair, sometimes, I sit on Ways and Means, and it's real common for an agency to find a cause and then strap on a couple of employees to go with it. And, if you're looking to, if you have a couple bad actors out there, I just really question the fact that we need to employ more people and expand government at this time to go after a couple bad actors to make the example that he's talking about. Having said that, I'd like the bill, so I'll probably vote for it, but I have some reservations about doing that, and I'll voice those reservations if it has a referral to Ways and Means.
One other thing I could add that might make you feel a little better, Senator Girard, is that the program itself is paid for by the tenants, not by general fund. The tenants self-tax themselves, and that's been in place for a number of years, $6 a year as an assessment, and it's collected with their personal property taxes, and that raises about $500,000 a year. And so these employees would come out of that money, would not come out of general fund.
Senator, is there a way to move this bill without authorizing the agency to bring on another half person? I mean, I guess that's what we're trying to do. I mean, at this point, it seems like a fairly small job. I mean, 230 phone calls. You know what I mean? How about I volunteer to do it? I mean, would that work? Because that way we can save a half position. I mean,
you're on the record.
I mean, I know I'd make them actually, if, save us $60,000.
Well, I believe that if we pass the bill out, we can go speak with the people who are in the position of making the determination about whether to refer this to Ways and Means. Any thoughts on that?
Well, if we did away with it, would you have to make the referral to Ways and Means?
If we did away with
the full-time the half full-time FTE?
Madam Chair, that's not in the bill.
It's not part of the bill.
It's part of the fiscal analysis.
Okay.
And I think the coalition view, if I might add, is the coalition view is that HCS needs some more staff to do a more thorough job. We're familiar with the people who work in the department now. One of them is in the back of the room, Teresa Wingard. So if you want to call her up and quiz her about whether she's got extra time to do that, I think I can probably say on her behalf that she does not have extra time. She's already very busy working with residents and landlords on issues.
So it appears that if the group that has put the bill together believes that it's necessary, then maybe they can, and it's paid for with funds from the tenants and from the fee for the landlord, that maybe then if it's referred to Ways and Means, they can make the case there.
Madam Chair, I think that's exactly right, that's essentially what Ways and Means does, and Senator Girard is going to be there keeping an eye out, so I would think that's appropriate.
So, Madam Chair, are we moving this to the floor or are we moving this to Ways and Means?
We're just passing the bill. It's up to the
Senate. And then they send it to the Secretary. It's up to the Secretary of the Senate and the President of the Senate
what they
to decide.
Would you like a motion?
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 772 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 772 as amended with the -2 amendment to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Ann, could we just have a roll call?
Senator Burgess?
Aye.
Senator Girard?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 772 moves to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, and the chair will carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 772 and open a work session on Senate Bill 929. Lori, can you please summarize where we are with Senate Bill 929?
Yes, I can very briefly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 929 has to do with the, requiring the manufactured dwelling park landlord to use sub-metering as a billing method when the landlord assesses tenant utility or service charge for water. There are two amendments before you in the packet that you have today. There's a dash one that has that provision 2012 inserted as the year for compliance, and a dash two that limits the application of the measure to manufactured dwelling parks with 200 or more spaces. There we have received fiscal impact statements and revenue impact statements for both amendments, and there's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact for either one.
Thank you very much. Committee, I wanted to give you a bit of an update on this bill that I've been working on and actually doing research about for quite some time. I did send an email to some of the people who were questioning. If you recall, in the hearing we had on this bill, there was some suggestion that perhaps what was required by this bill was, I believe the words were, against the law. And I wanted to clarify that from everything that I've seen and read, and don't take this as my legal advice, but from everything that I've seen and read, the Environmental Protection Agency had a rule where they exempted apartment complexes from having to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act, but with manufactured home parks, they said, we aren't going to do a blanket exemption. The states will look at those on a case-by-case basis to see who is the entity that needs to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act. And I went back and read an article that was actually written by Mr. Quirin, who is here testifying, where he says, to date, we know of no such cases where the EPA has sought to extend the Safe Drinking Water Act to a sub-metering program in a manufactured housing community. So that was something that Mr. Quirin had written in an article. And I haven't found any instance where that has actually happened, where the responsibility of complying with the Safe Drinking Water Act has been extended to the park by virtue of the sub-metering. One of the reasons why I had the amendment drafted for the 2012 implementation, and you may recall that some of the Heritage Village residents were here, and they would prefer that this happened immediately, but I wanted to give time for the parks to figure out how to do this and how to actually implement it and get that sub-metering in place. And I had talked about it the prior hearing on this, the example from Santa Clara County where they sub-metered, and I actually emailed the people there from their study, and they said it was actually pretty straightforward. They ended up doing about 1,200 manufactured homes. The cost was a couple hundred dollars per home. They ended up with a 22.5% reduction of water usage because, of course, with the sub-meters, the residents are aware of how much water they're using and how much they're conserving. And she said nobody even raised the issue of who was going to have to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act. So I also had the dash two amendment drafted, limiting the applicability of the measure to manufactured dwelling parks with 200 or more spaces. It seems like the larger parks are really where the residents are concerned about not being sub-metered and have run across the issue of having to take a pretty significant water bill and divide it among the units in the park. So again, the amendments were drafted to insert the 2012 year for compliance, so that's out in the future. Limit the application to parks with 200 or more spaces. That's the dash two. What I'd like to do today is with the committee adopt the dash one and the dash two, and then I would like to move the bill out on Thursday. It's back up again. Apparently there's some new questions raised, and I want to make sure that we address those. So if I could get a motion on the dash one and the...
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated March 16th to Senate Bill 929.
Senator George moves to adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 929. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The Dash 1 amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated April 13th to Senate Bill 929.
Senator George moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 929. Is there any discussion?
That's a good amendment.
Senator Gerard thinks that's a good amendment. Any other discussion? The Dash 2 amendments. Is there any objection? Dash 2 amendments are adopted. And then, as I explained, I would like to this back up for another work session on Thursday. And I'd like, if anybody has concerns, let's get those addressed immediately. I'd like to move that out on Thursday, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 929. And that concludes our business for today, so I'll adjourn. There are some new agendas out.